Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Today is the day the new Bruce Springsteen album officially comes out. So here is a Springsteen trivia question for you. You know how Bruce's longtime group is called the E Street Band? In what New Jersey town will you find E Street? If you said Asbury Park, you know you're Bruce Springsteen. But not necessarily your Springsteen trivia, because E Street is actually in another Jersey Shore town called Belmar. It's apparently where the band had its first rehearsal space, in keyboard player David Sanchez's house. We'll get a review of the new Springsteen album from writer Karen Rose. We also have live music today from a young guitar slinger from England named Jake Bugg. He topped the charts in the UK at 18, and now that he's 19, he's got his sights set on the States. But first, here's another trivia question for you. The performing rights organization BMI ranked all the top songs of the 20th century by how often they were heard on radio and TV. What was the number one song of the century? Now, this is a tough one, and until this weekend, I don't think I'd ever have come up with the right answer. But here it is. But baby, baby, I love it. Because I love thee. Oh, I love thee. You lost that love of me, and now it's gone, gone, gone. Oh. Yes, the Righteous Brothers recording of You've Lost That Lovin' Feelin' was ranked as the most performed song of the 20th century. I learned that from the playbill of the new Broadway show Beautiful, the Carole King musical. Not that Carole King wrote this song. This is actually one of many, many hits written by the husband and wife songwriting team of Barry Mann and Cynthia Weil. The Rock and Roll Hall of Famers were and are friends with Carole King and her then-husband and songwriting partner Jerry Goffin, and their early years together and all of their music are the subject matter for Beautiful, the Carole King musical. Barry, Cynthia, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thank you.
Thank you.
How weird is it seeing your early lives depicted on stage?
I love it. I mean, you know, also the actors who play us are so good. And the lines that were written for them are so good that I love it.
The Barry Mann character, played by Jared Spector, yeah. He gets all the best lines in the show.
Well, that's what happens in life also with my wife and myself.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Now, they do, Cynthia, sort of play Barry up as a kind of hopeless mass of neurotic hypochondria. How much of that? Tell me that that's like artistic.
It's 100%. You know, we gave them all the input, and Doug put it down on paper and wrote it the way it was.
He's
better now, right. But he was a mess of neurotic hypochondria.
To reinforce that, one of our guests was my doctor.
At the opening last night.
Uh-huh. The musical is called Beautiful, the Carole King musical, and it tells the story of Carole King and Jerry Goffin on the one hand and you two on the other. Why were there, it seemed like there were a number of married couples who were working in the period around what we called the Brill Building in the early 60s.
Right.
How did that happen? Why did that happen?
Well, there was us and Carole and Jerry and Jeff Barry and Ellie Greenwich.
Right.
And I don't know. I just think when you put the opposite sexes in a room to write a song, there's something very sexy about it. Things happen, you know, and they lead to marriage.
So which came first, the professional relationship or the personal one?
The personal.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Absolutely.
So that's a little bit different from the way it's presented in on the Broadway stage. They also have you guys not quite married for much of the musical.
Well, we were not quite married for a year.
Yeah.
And then which doesn't seem like a lot of time these days to be not quite married when people stay that way for 10 years. But in those days, it was pretty shocking.
Yeah.
Both of our mothers were very upset at the fact that we shared an apartment. And I lived in an apartment building, and we shared our apartment, and the elevator men were so embarrassed by it that they used to refer to Barry as there.
Hello there.
They'd say, good morning, Miss Weil. Good morning there.
So you scandalized even the doormen and
yes.
the elevator men
yes.
in the building. So we're talking about, what, 1961 thereabouts?
Yes,
that's it, yeah.
Now, Barry, you, the connection of this married couple with the Goffin King married couple mm-hmm. goes deeper than you had offices next door and you all cranked
right.
out all these hits.
Mm-hmm.
You, Barry, actually co-wrote a song with Jerry Goffin.
That's right. A song that's now, I mean, a standard that lives in the hearts of, and minds of people in the business. A song called Who Put the Bump in the Bump, Bump, Bump. And an artist sang it that I know very well, and that was me.
Let's hear Barry Mann. This is going back to, again, this is about 1961.
Yeah.
And who put the bump?
Who put the bump in the bump, a bump, a bump? Who put the rhyme in the ram-a-lam-a-ding-dong? Who put the bop in the bop, shabop, shabop? Who put the dip in the dip, di dip, di dip? Who was that man? I'd like to shake his hand. He made my baby fall in love with me. Yeah. When my baby heard bump, 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 every word went right into her heart. And when she heard them singing ram-a-lam-a-lam-a-lam-a-lam-a-ding-dong, she said we'd never have to part. So
Who Put the Bump, written by my guest Barry Mann, and not his longtime co-writer and wife Cynthia Weil, who's also here with me, but with Jerry Goffin, who was mm-hmm. part of the Goffin and King team. So was this before the two married couple / songwriting teams were fully formed?
I think we started to write.
We had started to write, but Jerry wrote with quite a few people at
mm-hmm.
that time.
Mm-hmm.
He wrote
That's
with
right.
Jack Keller,
mm-hmm.
and he wrote with you.
Right.
And he actually gave Barry that lyric as a joke.
Well, yeah.
And you thought it was funny and great and satirical. And
yeah, he hadn't finished it, you know, and I said, this is great. And also, I realized I was on ABC Paramount as a recording artist, and I really thought this could be a hit for me. And
mm-hmm.
I told them that. And, of course, I realized that it wouldn't be a career song. Career, you know. If Rolling Stone was around then, I wouldn't be the cover of Rolling Stone.
So it was kind of a novelty number. Kind
it
of,
was. I thought it was a very hip novelty song. I really
yeah.
did, yeah.
Yeah. So let me ask you guys to just back up and explain the whole Brill Building thing. First of all, you and Goffin and King worked for Aldon Music.
Yeah,
that's Don Kirshner.
Yeah.
And were they actually in the physical Brill Building?
No.
No, they were in 1650 Broadway, and the Brill Building was at 1619 Broadway. 1650 was the cheaper building. The rents were lower, and so you had more of the young publishers there who couldn't afford Brill Building rates.
Mm-hmm. And so what was the experience like working there? I mean, did you hear Carole King and Jerry Goffin's songs bleeding through the walls as you were
that
working?
That was it.
You could.
Really?
Yes,
yeah,
you,
yes,
could,
you really
yeah.
could. We could hear them. They could hear us.
And there were other writers, too, other
yeah.
writing teams that you could hear, too. It was very, very exciting and very, very anxiety-producing because we were all trying to get the same record. So it was a lot of angst.
There's a moment in the musical called Beautiful, where Don Kirshner basically says, I need a song for, is it the Shirelles?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I need it by 8 a.m. tomorrow.
Yeah.
And so your characters are off trying to write a song. The Carole King and Jerry Goffin characters are off trying to write a song. Did that actually
yes.
happen?
That actually happened.
Yeah, it did.
Yeah.
I mean, we didn't have it. I mean, by the way, we didn't always have to write in the cubicles that were there. We could write, go home and write too. But it did actually happen.
And the two songs that we hear in the musical that are a result of that, are they actually the ones that...
Our song was not written. The song of ours that they use, He's Sure the Boy I Love, was not written for the Shirelles, mm. but it worked. It was the same kind of thing where the crystals eat it by 9 o'clock tomorrow.
That's called He's Sure the Boy I Love.
And you know who's singing lead on that?
Who is singing lead on
Darlene Love.
Really?
Yeah,
Darlene's been on soundcheck a number of times. Amazing singer.
Yes.
Great.
So that was how, and again, I'll use the term the Brill Building in a kind of generic sense.
Yes.
Sure.
The songwriting factory that was here in Manhattan. So that's how it worked, is you would have an artist and you would write to that voice or group of voices?
Yeah. Yeah.
We would write what we thought would be right for that artist, but more than a factory, it was a school.
Yeah, that's...
It was like going to Rock and Roll University.
Hmm.
And we learned from each other. We learned from Kirshner. We learned from the radio. We were sponges, just soaking up everything we could learn about writing lyrics. And as Barry has always put it, we were the bridge between Tin Pan Alley and rock and roll.
Right. And you were young, right? I mean,
oh, yeah.
I mean, Goffin and King were like 17 and 19, but you guys were young too,
yes,
right?
Yeah,
were. I had my first hit even before I was with Alden. I had a hit when I was 19 years old, a song called She Say Doobie Doo. She say, oh. People must think I couldn't speak English. Who put the bump and she say doobie doom?
Then I came along and he started writing better lyrics.
And then we get to You've Lost That Loving Feeling,
right.
And things like that, and on Broadway and so many of the other hits. Barry Mann and Cynthia Weil, the songwriting team, Rock and Roll Hall of Famers, with me on Soundcheck today. They've been watching themselves on the Broadway stage with Beautiful, the Carole King musical, which is currently playing at the Stephen Sondheim Theater on West 43rd Street. And they could have just done a story about Carole King and Jerry Goffin. I mean, it's mm-hmm. it's a very interesting tale.
Mm-hmm.
But you guys were such a part of that story,
yes.
It seems.
Right.
Not just as competitors, but as friends.
Yes.
Have you guys remained friends over the years?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, we have.
And what does Carole think of this?
You know, Carole has been reluctant to see the show completely. She went to a reading. She made it to intermission and left in tears because it was just bringing back too many painful memories. And she didn't want to relive that part of her life. She said, I lived it already. I don't want to relive it again. But my feeling is that one night she is going to sneak in. And if she could sneak in with a veil of invisibility, I'm sure she would put one on because she doesn't want people to watch her watching it,
right.
You know?
Because the story is they fall in love. They write all these hit songs. They're very young. They have kids very young.
Mm-hmm.
And he's got a roving eye and some sort of instability problems,
right.
and things
mm-hmm.
things fall apart in a rather nasty way.
Right.
And she, of course, comes through it with Tapestry.
Yes.
You know,
mm-hmm.
25
yes.
million copies sold.
Exactly.
What about for you guys? I mean, you all went through the same thing of the mid-60s, the change from factories, songwriting teams that write the songs to artists writing their own material. That was like a big sea change in the music industry, and you all had to deal with that.
Yeah, but it's interesting. I know when the English sound came in, the Beatles and everybody else, all the songwriters were worried about it, including Cynthia and myself. But if you look at our catalog, We wrote You've Lost That Love and Feeling during that period. We wrote Soul and Inspiration during that period. We wrote We Gotta Get Out of This Place. So with all our fears, it didn't matter. We just kept going straight ahead, and we did great.
All right, well, you mentioned We Gotta Get Out of This Place, a song that the Animals famously recorded. Let's hear some of that.
Watch my dad.
And their recording of We Gotta Get Out of This Place, a song one of many hits written by my guests Barry Mann and Cynthia Weil. And Cynthia, Barry, this is a song that became almost a kind of anthem of the anti-war movement in the 60s. And during that period, it seems that the two of you started exploring a more tense, socially conscious territory in your songwriting. Mm-hmm. Not that we always got to hear it, right? Mm. Tell us the story of Only in America.
Oh, that's a great story.
Only in America was a song that we wrote for the Drifters. And we had originally planned it as this sarcastic, Only in America, Land of Opportunity, do they save a seat in the back of the bus just for me? Only in America, where they preach the golden rule, do they start to march when my kids want to go to school? And we played it for Lieber and Stoller, and they said, "You're crazy. We'll never get this on the air." And they said, "Let's write a different lyric, and we'll have the Drifters record it, and everyone will understand that it's satire, that it's not true." So we wrote the lyric that now exists.
Well, only in America can you grow up to be president, which is kind of an interesting line.
And so the Drifters recorded it, and when they sent it out, Black radio wouldn't play it. Of course, radio was still segregated, you know. I mean, I don't know whether it still is today, but there was black stations and white stations.
And they felt that was a lie.
Yeah, which is true. It was a lie in those days. Mm-hmm. And so they took the same track and recorded it with Jay and the Americans, a white group, and it was a hit.
But let's hear the original version that you meant for us to hear. This is from the Drifters.
Only in America can a guy from anywhere go to sleep a pauper and wake up a millionaire? Only in America can a kid without a cent get a break and maybe grow up to be president. Only in America, land of opportunity. Washing cars, take a giant step and reach right up and touch the stars. Only in America.
That's the Drifters with Only in America, not the version that you would have heard on the radio, which was a sort of sanitized version from Jay and the Americans. But Barry Mann and Cynthia Weil wrote that song. This, Cynthia, is the version that was sent to the black radio stations that they refused to play.
Right. Yeah.
Right.
So how did the songwriting process work? Was it always, Cynthia, you're doing the lyrics and Barry, you're doing the music?
In those days, it pretty much was. I mean, after a while, Barry wrote a couple of lyrics by himself, and then I hit him over the head a few times and he stopped doing that.
Right.
He started behaving himself.
Right. And which would happen first?
You know, it worked all different ways. Sometimes it came from a melody. Very often it came from a melody or a riff or a feel. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it came from a title. Sometimes it came from just knowing the artist that we were writing for.
Right. Was it odd to write songs? Did it ever happen that you wrote songs and did not know who was going to sing it?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
What about on Broadway? Who was that written for?
Oh, that's what I was thinking about.
That was originally written for a group that Carol and Jerry were recording called The Cookies.
Yeah.
It's a girl's song, and then it got changed.
Yeah, Cynthia and I originally wrote it without Lieber and Stola.
Uh-huh.
You know, it had a different perspective. It was like they say the neon lights. I hear the neon lights are bright on Broadway. I hear that dreams come true there every day. I hear that life don't get you down the way it gets you in this small town. I swear I gotta get me there someday. That was the concept for a small, you know, a girls group from a small town. And then we ended up playing it for Lieber and Stola because we thought, well, maybe if the lyric change would be great for the Drifters. And they loved it, and they said, well, you know, this is could be good for the Drifters, but you have to change the lyric. So you could either write it with us, or you could go home and write it yourselves. So we jumped at the chance to write with Lieber and Stola, because they were just great writers, you know. And that's how, and it became even a much, much better song.
They say the neon lights are bright on Broadway.
Of the Drifters' version of On Broadway, written by Barry Mann and Cynthia Weil, and Lieber and Stoller. Two great songwriting teams collaborating on that song, which the Drifters had a hit with, and then, of course, George Benson, years later, would have a mega hit with.
That moment in All That Jazz, the Bob Fosse film, when they used the Benson record, was mind-blowing.
Yeah. So, Barry, you have been a singer. You've even done a little impromptu singing right here in our studio today. In the wake of Who Put the Bomb, you know, kind of a novelty hit, ever have any regrets that you didn't follow up on that? I mean, I know you've done some recordings and stuff, but any regrets that you didn't pursue actively a performing career?
I did pursue it, just nobody knows. I think I was probably on more labels than any artist ever. I think I was on about 14 or 15
labels. You were on 13 labels.
13 labels. She kept count.
Yes. And each misstep was a new kind of misstep. With each label, he made a new mistake.
That's the truth.
Often didn't listen to someone who knew better.
Gee, who could that have been?
But I think somehow in his heart he really did not want to be an artist. I think he kept shooting himself in the foot.
You know, I had a fear of performing, you know, and I think that, you know, that was always there in the back of my mind, which kept me from really, really doing it. I mean, there were so many times I should have been going for the throat when it came to cutting an album. You know, really trying to get 10 songs that were hits, undeniable hits. Like Michael Jackson did, you know, later on.
Like Carol did
and
in
like,
Tapestry.
And like Carol did, right, in Tapestry. And I just didn't do it. I got very, you know, I was very taken with what was happening you know, on radio at that time. And I did songs that were very esoteric, you know. And there were also songs that were not right for me vocally. You know, I didn't realize, look, I had a certain kind of sound and that I should have been cutting songs that matched up with my sound, and I didn't do that.
I mean, because as writers we wrote in different genres, he didn't have the direction that an artist should have. Who am I? What do I sing? You know, what is the real me?
Right. If you want to hear what I really sounded like, and where I did come together was the last album I did. It was called Soul and Inspiration, and I did kind of an acoustic piano vocal, you know, kind of an unplugged kind of album, and that really captures who I am.
Now, Cynthia said something interesting that, you know, you didn't see yourselves as genre songwriters. You weren't rock and roll songwriters or R&B songwriters.
Right.
You were just songwriters.
Yes, exactly. And I don't think that the different kinds of writing were as delineated then. We never thought, oh, we can't write country. Kirshner would say, Leroy Van Dyke had just had a big hit with Walk On By, and he was recording for another session, and we were told to go write for him. So we wrote a song that was pure country, and mm-hmm. we got the record.
We'll hear a little bit of that to wrap up. We've been speaking with the songwriting team of Barry Mann and Cynthia Weil. You can see their early years depicted in the new Broadway show Beautiful, the Carole King musical, playing at the Stephen Sondheim Theater. Barry, Cynthia, this has been great fun. Thank you so much.
Yeah, it's fun for us, too.
Pleasure to meet you, great. And it's a pleasure to be here.
And though I break away to meet you anyhow, I have to say, please remember you call. If a woman answers, hang up the phone. Don't take a chance. Please don't ask for me.
That's If a Woman Answers from country legend Leroy Van Dyke, one of the many songs written by Cynthia Weil and Barry Mann. Up next, we get a review of Bruce Springsteen's new album, which technically came out today. I'll explain in a moment. Plus, later on the show, live music from the young British phenom, Jake Bugg. This is Soundcheck.
Got high hopes. I got high hopes. Got high hopes. I got high hopes.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Today, Bruce Springsteen officially released his 18th album called High Hopes, and I say officially because the album has been streaming online for about a week and probably floating around on file-sharing services after a much-publicized leak from Amazon. That's given Springsteen fans time to spend with this album, which is something of an odd duck. The music writer Karen Rose reviewed High Hopes for Billboard and joins me here in the Soundcheck studio with her reaction. Karen, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So what is this album? Is this kind of like when The Who did their Odds and Sods thing?
That's probably not an unfair comparison, because no one really criticized them for putting a bunch of stuff that hadn't had a place previously. You know, Bruce said this is stuff I had lying around and I really wanted to get out. So he had some covers that hadn't, you know, they had started recording, and then he had these songs that he had never done an album version of, and then some, you know, outtakes, for lack of a better word, and then some other songs that sort of floated in between.
Right. Now, and for you as a major Springsteen fan, I mean, one of your books charts your peregrinations through Europe following the Springsteen tour of 2012. How did you feel, you know, knowing that this was going to be the next? Were you anticipating it? Did you think, oh, that's going to be the next?
More the latter. The, oh, no, you know, it was, oh, you're rushed. This is coming out so quickly after the end of a tour. We haven't had a great experience with that previously, with Working on a Dream. And, you know, some of the older songs, you know, you're thinking, well, if they didn't make the record, there was a reason they didn't make the record. Bruce is a really good editor. So really was sort of not looking forward to it. And then the day of the leak, got it, and was, after the first listen, was like, this is actually pretty good in spots. So it was kind of a relief.
Yeah, give me one of your favorite tracks from High Hopes.
Frankie Fell in Love. I don't know why it wasn't the single. It's a wonderful, beautiful, you know, exemplar of all the stuff Bruce does best.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's poppy, it's fun. There's a good sing along. It's a good story. There's great fun imagery. It's just end to end a hit.
And any idea which sort of drawer he pulled this out of?
You know, there's been a lot of non-specific answers about where this came from. It came from a notebook somewhere and re-recorded it. You know, there's been also a lot of interviews that's been tough to keep track of where he's saying this came from here. No, actually it came from here. And, you know, there was one yesterday where he's like, oh, that came from Magic. And the interviewer said, actually, I think you were quoting these lyrics in 2002. Oh, was I? So then maybe that was Rising. So it came from somewhere.
Okay. Let's hear a little bit. Frankie Fell in Love from the new Bruce Springsteen record, High Hopes.
Good morning, good morning. church mass snoring. News is out all over town. Reggae feeling love. Wake up, boys, wake up. You drunken choir boys, shake it up. Heard Juliet says Romeo's been found. Reggae feeling love. Well, peace don't break out. From here on in, we can take out. She ain't gonna be cooking for the likes of us. Somebody call Mama and just tell her. Frankie fell in love.
That's called Frankie Fell in Love, a track from the new Bruce Springsteen album out today called High Hopes. The author and music writer Karen Rose reviewed it for Billboard and is reviewing it for us on Soundcheck today. So am I hearing the late Clarence Clemons saxophone sort of in the back of the mix there?
I don't think Clarence is on this one. I don't have the liner notes yet, so I haven't been able to check track by track. That's a little, the only frustrating thing about a leak.
Right.
So I don't know if Clarence is on that. He is on some of them, and... When I know I made notes and I was like, that's Clarence.
He is on this record
because some of the recordings are older recordings. You know, Danny Federici is also on this record. So, you know, we blissfully still get some last, you know, and, you know, I wonder how many other recordings he has. But we do get to hear Clarence and Danny one last time. And when you hear them, you know it's them.
So the members of the E Street Band, as one would expect. But there's an unexpected musician who is all over this new record.
Tom Morello.
From Rage Against the Machine and Audioslave. And how big an impact does his presence have?
Well, when Bruce Springsteen calls you his muse, I think that's a pretty big impact. You know, he's on 8 of the tracks on the record. He's on some of even the much older tracks like Harry's Place, which is definitely a rising outtake, so 2002, you know, came in and definitely left his mark all over the record. And Bruce just seems really energized and inspired by him.
To the point that it almost sounds like, from what I've read, things that Springsteen has said, it almost sounds like it was meeting and working with Tom Morello that sort of gave him the impetus to put this collection of tunes together.
You know, I think Bruce has wanted to go out with another band or thought about doing it, but the last time he did that, it didn't really work out so well. So I think he just wants to add as many people as he can to E Street. And I guess that's how he can work with somebody, you know, he can work with a guitarist like Tom.
Mm-hmm. Now, we hear the two of them working together on this song called Ghost of Tom Joad.
This is just, it's just, they just nailed it, you know. They could have, not that it would have been bad, but there is just something so incredibly magical about that song, and which before only existed live and only existed, you know, when Tom was around. And it's you know, literally, it is still like you know, I was pounding the desk the first time I heard it. Just like, yeah, you guys, the vocals are the emotions there in the vocals, the emotion is there in the performance. Just all around, the best thing about this record.
The original Tom Joad is from 1996, but here is the new recording, Ghost of Tom Joad, Bruce Springsteen, the new album High Hopes, featuring Tom Morello.
Now Tom said, Mama River's a cop beating a guy. River hungry, newborn baby cries. There's a fight against the blood and hatred in the air. Look for me, Mom, I'll be there.
Well, if somebody's fighting for a place to stand, or a decent job or a helping hand, if somebody's struggling to be free, look in their eyes, Ma, you'll see me.
Bruce Bruce Springsteen's Ghost of Tom Joad with Tom Morello, helping out on the new Springsteen album, High Hopes. We're speaking with the author and music writer Karen Rose about the new Springsteen release. And the original Ghost of Tom Joad is Springsteen at his most explicitly Woody Guthrie.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And that, I could see that appealing to Tom Morello, knowing his political inclinations.
Yes.
And so they really, I mean, this is a very kind of strongly felt performance.
It always gives me goosebumps. It's always, you know, I've been privileged to see it a couple of times. I mean, it's the kind of thing I would have, you used to only be able to see it if you went to Southern California, because that's where Tom lives, so that's where he's most likely to show up. And then, you know, got to see it at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame 25th anniversary in London at Hyde Park. And just, you know, it means a lot to them. Mm-hmm. And I think they love singing it together.
Now, there are several tracks on this record that you would have had to see in live performance and you know, are now finally coming out on disc. One of them is American Skin, 41 Shots, which Springsteen wrote after the Amadou Diallo shooting.
Yes.
Here in New York. This is something that, you know, fans would already be familiar with, right?
Fans would be already be familiar with it. He has played it since then in reaction to current events. Sometimes it's explicit, like Trayvon Martin.
Mm-hmm.
Other times, you know, he played it at the last show of the tour in Kilkenny, Ireland. And I was in tears. And I had been traveling, and all I could think was, did something happen that I don't know about that he's playing this? It's another very emotional, very highly charged political song.
So given the fact that there are these songs that fans will have had some experience with, who is this album for? Is it for the completist? Is it for the diehard fan?
Well, I don't think so, because he really thinks these are songs that people should hear. That, you know, they're in that sense, they're not an odds and sods, because there are songs he feels strongly about that they needed a home, and that there should be a record. There should, you know, that he's thinking about his legacy. You know, he's thinking about his age. Mm. And I think he wants to make sure this stuff is recorded and there's a definitive version.
Well, you know, for a lot of people, I guess part of the fun of this record is what we were talking about before, is trying to determine the provenance of some of the songs. All right, now when would he have written that? Which period of Bruce Springsteen are we talking about here? With the song called Heaven's Wall, where is this part of the mythic Lost Gospel album?
The Great Lost Gospel album. You know, we heard about it. He admitted it. He admitted that Shackled and Drawn came from that project. So I'm, you know, it's been placed in a couple of places. It feels like it came from that part of the world. If I run into him again, I'm going to ask him. I'm going to ask him about the gospel record. I'm going to take a stand and put it there.
Mm-hmm. So this is another great Tom Morello contribution as well.
Yes, absolutely. You know, it's another, Bruce and him trading off sort of one gunslinger against the other. You know, and it just, you wouldn't think Tom Morello on a gospel track, but he fits in and he made it work.
Here is Heaven's Wall from the new album High Hopes by Bruce Springsteen. Wall is the name of that song from Bruce Springsteen with guitarist Tom Morello. The album High Hopes officially out today, although there was that leak from the folks at Amazon. So it's been out on the interwebs for a few weeks now. But
yes, it was on Amazon, and then it wasn't on Amazon, and it was.
But it was too late.
It was too late.
The story is that Amazon sort of accidentally put up the tracks. And somebody went and grabbed them. And then once they had done that, even when Amazon realized its mistake and took the page down, somebody had the tracks and was able to start file sharing. And,
yes.
And it has spread. But today is the official release of the record. Karen Rose is with us, the author and music writer, who's reviewed it for Billboard. On balance, is this a good record?
Yes, it is a good record. Absolutely. I can say that.
I feel a big but coming.
You know, we have to give Billboard, we give scores, and we give numeric scores, and I really hate to be that person, and it's tough for me. And I gave it an 82, and I really feel like that's a fair number. Although, you know, you feel like, who am I to give Bruce Springsteen a grade?
A B, yeah.
Yeah, pretty much. You know, I do think that some of the older tracks might have used a little more updating. You know, I'm really intrigued by Harry's Place. But after repeated listens, it starts to feel like a Eagles outtake.
Hmm.
Musically.
So you can understand why it was left off of The Rising.
I think it was left off of The Rising, not because of how it sounded, but because the story that he tells would have taken you out of the arc
of
that he
record.
Created of
yeah,
that record.
Right. One of the things that struck me were the covers, including the title track, High Hopes, but also the Suicide song, Alan Vega and Martin Rev's Dream Baby Dream, which was a surprising choice, I thought.
It was a surprising choice when it showed up on the tour. We knew that he liked them. I actually interviewed Alan Vega after this. He did this. I interviewed him for Backstreet's Magazine, and he told me these great stories about how they were in the record plant at the same time, and they were in the bathroom drinking vodka together.
This would have been back like 1980, we're talking
yeah,
about.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And, because everyone heard Suicide's influence in Nebraska, and you know, they knew each other, and mm-hmm. you know, I know Alan thinks that he thinks this is such a great version that he'll have to sing it. He has to sing it that way now, or Bruce did it.
All right, the song is "Dream Baby Dream," originally from the band Suicide, but covered by Bruce Springsteen from the album High Hopes. Karen Rose, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Come on and open up your heart. Come on, dream on.
Up next, live music from the chart-topping young British star Jake Bugg, right here in our soundcheck studio.
They grin, but they don't mean it. They sing, but they don't feel it. They come, but they don't see it. They can call, but they can't eat it. Think, but they don't speak it. There's a beast eating every bit of beauty, and they all feed it. Stop. Moment, try to
this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. In 2012, British singer and guitarist Jake Bugg became the youngest male artist to ever land a debut record at the number one spot on the UK charts. He was 18. He's a bit older now, like by a year, but the raw energy that helped his debut swagger to the top hasn't dimmed a bit. Bugg's second album is called Shangri-La, and it features another batch of cheeky, observant songs steeped in rock, folk, and rockabilly. Jake Bugg joins me in the Soundcheck studio with acoustic guitar in hand. He's going to play a few tunes live for us, beginning with Slumville Sunrise. Here's Jake Bugg live on Soundcheck.
My window, I haven't slept all night. That drum just keeps on banging. They must be buzzing at the mind. Stop beating a half. Tell me when the morning arrives. These places just not for me. I say it all the time. My friends, they just ignore me. Tell me never mind. Waiting on your life on a Slumville Sunrise. Slumville Sunrise. Nobody cares or looks twice. Shine away in the morning. Cross your place. I was born in every rose, every flower, illuminated by the dawning. My face upon the concrete, the dirt is in my mouth. I clench my fists and feet. I'm trying to cry out loud, make a sound. Something is keeping me down. This place is just not for me. I said a thousand times. My friends, they just ignore me. Tell me never mind. Waiting on your life on a small view sunrise. Slumville Sunrise. Nobody cares or looks twice.
every rose, every flower, illuminated by the dawning.
That is Jake Bugg, live on Soundcheck with his song called Slumville Sunrise. Jake's newest album, his second, is called Shangri-La. It was released in November, and Jake joining us for the first time here in the Soundcheck studio today. Let me ask you about that title, Slumville Sunrise. I mean, you're from Nottingham, England, right?
Yeah.
Where is Slumville? Are you...
Well, you know, it could kind of, you know, you could say it's about, you know, where I'm from, but you know, it's not the only bad place in the world, you know.
Right, right. So what was it like to spend 12 months, not just at the top of the charts, but all the touring and everything that comes with it, and then to go back to what is a fairly small town by New York and London standards?
Yeah, man, it was, it was very strange. I mean, it's when you first get on the road, you just want to go back home. And when you go back home, you want to go back on the road. And, you know, I love being on the road and seeing the world. And, you know, I stayed in my bedroom for, you know, until I was 17 and never went out of England. So it was, you know, I'm doing what I wanted to do.
So now you're making up for lost time.
Yeah, man, yeah.
So now you've been here in New York before. You were telling me your first experience of New York was during the superstorm, during Sandy.
Yeah, it was, yeah.
That must have been completely surreal.
It was very strange. And I think they put in some law for a little bit where you could only get into Manhattan if you had three people in your car or something.
That's right.
And that was pretty crazy. And so you got police checking all the cars and there's trees, you know, just all over the place. And no, so I'd never seen anything like it.
Well, can I tell you, neither had we.
Crazy, man. It was a very strange atmosphere that day.
So now you're back under more conventional circumstances. And how are you finding this second go-round? I mean, there's a lot of pressure, you know, when a first album succeeds the way your first record did.
Well, you know, the only pressure all the pressure kind of comes from myself. I want to prove to myself I can continue to follow up the success of the first record and still write songs for people to enjoy. And, you know, I'm never going to let anybody, you know, when it comes to making records, you know, I know how to make them.
Mm-hmm. The guy you made this one with, the album Shangri-La, also knows how to make a record or two.
Oh, yes.
The great Rick Rubin, who's done everything from metal to hip-hop to those great late Johnny Cash records. How did this happen?
It was a great experience. I mean, I believe my manager's put in a request and, you know, just to see what would happen. And, you know, Rick got back in touch and, you know, much to our surprise, I think, and decided to take on, you know, it was only meant to record two songs. And he was like, what other ideas you got? And recorded them. And we kind of thought, oh, we could make an album here. And I just do what I do, write the songs, and Rick does what he does and produce it and, you know, puts cool musicians around you and great ideas, great advice. And yeah, I just had a really nice time being in one place and making music again.
Did you know who Rick Rubin was before?
I'd heard the name. I didn't really know, you know, the reputation he had. But I think that kind of helped in a way because it allowed me just to meet the guy for who he was without having a, you know, a perspective of him or, you know, being in awe in any way and just, you know, meeting him for who he was and making records.
So you went there to do two songs and you came back with a whole album, basically.
Pretty much, yeah.
So you must have had... These songs must have been sort of gestating at some point before you went over there. This was L.A., right?
Yeah,
Southern California.
A lot of them were just ideas I'd written on the road or wherever. And when I got into the studio, Rick was kind of good at, you know, making sure that I got these songs out of me and, you know, and made them into songs, these ideas that I had. And that was cool, and which created more space for and allowed new songs to be created because I'd got those ideas out. And then after that first session, I did a nice little trip around Nashville and Memphis and did some demos in the Sun Studios, which was pretty sweet.
Wow.
And then went back to the Malibu to finish record the ideas that I'd written while I was there.
Now, the Sun Studio that you were in, it's the same, you know, physical place as, like, Elvis Presley and all that. It's been sort of redone, but my understanding is when you go in there now, it really looks and kind of sounds the way it did 50 years ago.
Yeah, man, and it's, you know, you can really feel a nice, you know, whatever it is in there, it's a nice feeling, and, you know, and to be, you know, stood there with your guitar and playing the songs and thinking of all the people that had stood there previously playing their songs, you know, it's a pretty crazy realization.
Yeah. I want to sort of follow up on that after we hear another song or two, because, you know, there are elements of that kind of Nashville and Memphis sound in what you do, despite being from Nottingham, England. but you want to do another song for us? You want to play Me and You?
Yeah, man, I'll do that. Yeah.
All right. We're speaking with Jake Bugg, spelled with two G's, B-U-G-G. His second album is the latest, Shangri-La, which was recorded in Rick Rubin's recording studio by that name. The studio is called Shangri-La as well, in Malibu, California. The English singer, songwriter, and now strapping on the guitar again to play for us a song called Me and You. Here's Jake Bugg live on Soundcheck.
All the time, people follow us where we go. We both should believe the path that we chose. And I hold you with such delicacy, 'cause they won't catch you and me. All over the road all the time, and if you want to, I won't mind. Please don't leave it, I don't know what to do, 'cause they won't catch me. There are too many flashes and Gordons round. There's too little time and places to see, and we can wait so patiently, 'cause they won't catch you and me. It's all over.
That is Jake Bugg live on Soundcheck in a song called Me and You, which you will find on his second album, the latest, called Shangri-La. And there's lots of influences to be felt in, you know, in your music. I mean, there's a song like What Doesn't Kill You, which has a kind of punk energy. This song is obviously more ballad-based. But a lot of your music has a really kind of classic early rock and roll, rockabilly kind of sound.
Well, I listen to a lot of old music. I don't really like a lot of, you know, contemporary records, let's say. But, you know, I don't understand why that music sounds good to me. It just does. And, you know, and...
Did you grow up with it in the house?
Bits of it. I mean, my mum had a funny taste. She could listen to, you know, some cool stuff and then some really awful stuff.
Like, define cool stuff.
Well, you know, like, you know, she might have had a Donovan record lying about, and then she could have something like, you know, a boy band record or something like that. And she liked classical music as well, so quite varied. But, you know, but, like, that's why I thought I wouldn't get into music, because my mum and dad liked it, and so you kind of want to rebel against
right.
you know, what they do. But somehow I picked up a guitar, and, you know, it sounded good to me.
So what did you want to be when you grow up?
I wanted to be a footballer.
You wanted to be
soccer
a football.
Player, I should say.
One of the local teams, Notts County, you have a standing invite to play with them?
I can train with them. I don't think they'll let me play when they see my ball skills.
Jake's newest album, his second, is called Shangri-La. The Nottingham English singer, songwriter, and guitarist Jake Bugg's been with us here in the Soundcheck studio. And Jake, it's been a lot of fun having you. Thanks very much.
Oh, no, thank you, man.
Johnny deals a bitter blow on the side. Thinks that he's invincible. Hates a fight. Janie walks the streets alone.
You can hear another song played live in our studio and watch a video of Jake Bugg over at soundcheck.org. Tomorrow on the show, Paul Williams wrote hits like An Old-Fashioned Love Song and Rainbow Connection and many, many others. Now he's the president of ASCAP, the American Society of Composers, Authors, and Publishers. He joins us to talk about the group as it turns 100 years old and the challenges they face today. Plus live music from the screaming eagle of soul himself, Charles Bradley. A new documentary tells the tale of how he went from being a James Brown impersonator to simply being himself on stage. We'll hear some of his latest album called Victim of Love. That does it for the show today. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.